Well, thank you, and good morning. It's nice to be here. I've met so many of you in the past, and I really do appreciate the opportunity to bring a message to you. It has nothing to do with food, so you don't have to. There won't be any cooking lessons here. But passion is something that I love talking about because it's been a great study of mine. It's really the one component that propelled me to be successful at what I did. And, you know, people would come to the Waldorf, and after touring the kitchens, they would ask me, how do you get these people so inspired? They noticed how people were so intense and so friendly and so active and just so detail-oriented. You could tell that they loved what they did. And they would ask me, how do you get them to be so inspired and so passionate? And my answer was always, I don't know, they're good people. I never really had to figure it out. It just happened. We did lots of things to get there, but I never really studied it per se until I left the Waldorf and people would say to me, I want you to do for me what you did at the Waldorf. I want you to bring passion to my enterprise, to my business, to my group. And it wasn't until then that I really had to start and break it down and think about what is passion and how do we get there? So really, what is passion? Passion is, it's an energy, right? It's not tangible. It's a feeling. It's an energy. If you put love on a scale of 1 to 10, passion is 10. So we love lots of things, right? We love our friends. We love our house. We love our animals or our pets, our kids. And not necessarily in that order, but we love lots of things. But when we think about the things that we love the absolute, the most, that we are obsessed with and we are so passionate about, it's the greatest form of love. And we're going to get into how we get there because it's not something that's innate. You know, we like to think that passion, well, he's a really passionate guy or she's really passionate and that's the way they are and that's great, that's a gift. Not so. We can learn to be passionate and we can get other people to become passionate as well. And that will be the key to our success in anything that we do. So here I've got a couple of visionaries. Clearly, these are passionate people. These people change the world that we live in and as we know it. These are our world leaders. They have changed the music world. They have changed the food world. They have changed the way we communicate with each other. They've changed sports. They have gotten rid of segregation and bias. And they have stood up for what they believed in and their vision. And nothing got in the way of their vision because they were such a high degree of desire to achieve what they wanted to do. You would think that all these people here are great people, but I hate to disappoint you, they're not. These are ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. And we all have the ability to do extraordinary things. But to do that, you need to have a vision, a crystal clear vision of what it is you want and the strongest desire to get there. And we're going to go through how we get that. So my story about the Waldorf, it's not the story of a chef. So, you know, it has nothing to do with being a chef. Okay? It has to do has everything to do with overcoming adversity and obstacles, of which we are all faced with every day. Even if you work by yourself, and I'm not talking about work-related and employees. Yes, my story was about affecting the behavior of employees, but what I practiced can apply to your social group, your church organization, if you're coaching a basketball team or a soccer team, your work, even if you work alone and you have constituents outside of your business, as long as you're dealing with people, you will be more successful when you find your passion and you can share it with other people and get them locked into your vision and what it is that you want to achieve. And the same thing is reverse. You know, we're here to help other people accomplish their dreams and goals as well. So the Waldorf is a pretty amazing place. I'll give you a brief overview of this monster. The original Waldorf sat, It was two buildings, the Waldorf and the Astor Hotels. It sat in New York City where the Empire State Building is today. They knocked them down and they built the Empire State Building in 18 months. Can you imagine that? It's still one of the most majestic buildings in the city. And they moved the Waldorf to 50th and Park. And it is a full city block long, 42 stories high. Okay, I'll give you an idea of perspective. A really good restaurant, if you and I were going to go be partners and we wanted to open a restaurant, we'd really be pushing it. And if we set a goal of making $6 million a year, that's a really good, busy restaurant. Okay, $6 million a year in food and beverage sales. The Waldorf did average 7.5 million food and beverage per month. We served 1 million people a year. It was a madhouse. We had kitchens. The main kitchen was a city block square with sub-departments all along the way. We had three restaurants, each with their own kitchen and their own staff, a room service kitchen that fed 1,467 rooms. Now, keep in mind, a luxury hotel today, if you build a luxury hotel today, you keep it to about 350 rooms because that's a number where you can really focus on quality and attention to detail and a very high level of service. So why they built something so big with that intention is beyond me, but that's what made it legendary, and that remains today, and that's the challenge of anybody that works there. We had 150 staff in the kitchen, and I learned that, you know, I was only going to be as good as the people that I surrounded myself with, so trying to inspire, my goal was to inspire them to do great work, which took me many, many years to do, which we'll get into. But, you know, some of the things we did, I had a nice little dinner party there. That was a great moment. Actually, that was not at the Waldorf. That was at Governor's Island, but the State Department asked me to prepare that meal when Gorbachev came to this country, and you can recognize some of the people around the table from Colin Powell to George Bush and President Reagan at the time and Chevronandez and Schultz and so many world leaders. It was such a proud moment to be part of that. I was so lucky and fortunate. But that's some of the pressure that was upon myself and my colleagues in trying to meet and exceed people's expectations. Because people see that, and when you go to the Waldorf, you expect an experience that was beyond your imagination. And it made it very difficult in something that was so big, with so many details and so many behaviors to manage, but that was the challenge. And look, along with other world events, I got to meet the Sids out at the ranch. I love this story because I love cowboys, okay? I wish I was a cowboy. I have two pairs of cowboy boots. I know that doesn't make me a cowboy. And they're really nice boots, and I would never get them dirty, so that really doesn't make me a cowboy. But I love cowboys, and I love being on the ranch. And a funny story is I went out on a ranch, and we had such a nice time, and we did some really nice things for certified Angus beef. But walking back from the field to the house, the camera crew was a little bit ahead of me, and they stopped in the dirt road. I was trying to walk on the grass because I didn't want to get my boots dirty. And this guy comes. It looked like a cowboy. He was a cowboy. He was dressed up as a cowboy anyway, I thought. So he had the hat and the boots and the horse and the rope. And he's talking with the camera crew. And I'm thinking, boy, that is pretty cool. They even staged something like this. And so I think I asked Mark McCulley about it. And he says, that's a cowboy. I said, really? I've watched cowboy movies. I thought that was like from the 1800s. They still have cowboys today? Oh, yeah, sure. So I got on the phone. I called home and said, yeah, I'm going to believe this. They got real cowboys out here. Talk about how naive I am. But at the same time, because I was busy doing other things there. See, President Reagan, this is a great little story. This was the 40th anniversary of the United Nations. And behind him in that room sat Margaret Thatcher, Helmut Kohl, Nakasone from Japan, Craxi from Italy, and I'm missing somebody. It was six of them. Anyway, a very historic event, and I can tell you over the 29 years that I was there, that only happened once, the world leaders in one room like that. And so I was in the next room preparing the food up in the presidential suite, and when it was all over, the State Department official said to me, listen, President Reagan, this was my first presidential dinner. I was on the job as executive chef for like 4 months. And I was so excited just to be part of it. It was awesome. And the guy from the State Department says, listen, the president usually likes to thank the staff, but this is just over the top, and he's just so focused on entertaining this party. But thank you very much. I said, hey, no problem. I'm just proud to be part of it. And with that, they escorted me down the hallway and onto the elevator where there was another Secret Service gentleman. The elevator's door closed, and we didn't go anywhere. And the guy puts his finger to his ear. He's listening, and he talks into his cuff. And he puts his arm down, and he says, the president would like to see you. And I almost fell down. So they opened the doors, and they walked me back. And I waited outside right in that stage there. And that's where the president came out and gave me the most gracious gesture of appreciation for this event and how much it meant. And so, I mean, I just wanted to walk out and just scream and tell everybody on the street what's what I was just part of, because it really was being part of event. So that's some of the things that the great things that I was able to experience at the Waldorf. So it was tremendous. But I have to say that it was not like everything in life, right? There's good and bad, and it had its challenges. And I have grown so much because of the challenges. And what I've learned at probably the most valuable lesson I learned at the Waldorf is that we as people, we don't grow and we don't learn when we're sitting back and enjoying life. And we're supposed to have moments where we sit back and enjoy life and enjoy everything around us. But we're not growing. And God didn't put us down here not to grow and not to change this world and make it a better place. When we're confronted with adversity, with disaster, with big problems, with things that stress us out, that's when we figure out how to be different. That's when we figure out what we have to do to make changes in our lives and the lives of other people. So we have to learn to embrace these challenges. It's hard to do because it can bog you down and say, why are all these things happening to me? But they're happening for a reason, and they're there to deal with. And we've got, there's something I always had to do when we're faced with adversity, we've got three choices of how we're going to deal with it. We're going to change it and fix it. That's a choice. That's what I like to do. But sometimes you can't. So when you can't change it and fix it, you have to accept it. You have to accept it in your heart and in your mind. Because if it's not coming from your heart and mind, you're just going to be resentful and you're going to be miserable. So we have to change our expectations sometimes. And so we can either change something or we can accept it. Or the worst thing, the last choice, which is not a choice for me, and that's to be the victim. And to give into it. And why is this happening to me? And I can't believe they're doing this to me. And why me, and why me, and me? And we just go right down the tube. So, you know, playing the victim is never an option for me. And it's a very dangerous place to be. And I guess we all do it at some points in our lives with some things. But it's really a great thing to resist to help us move forward. So I'm going to tell you, I did have a mountain to climb. It's not a story. John Sticca has encouraged me to incorporate this into my presentation because I guess it is very important. The dark side of my job is really what propelled me to achieve a certain level of greatness and success. So when I started at the Waldorf at 19 years old, I came from the Culinary Institute of America, where I learned what cooking was supposed to be and how it was supposed to look and how you're supposed to do it. And it was all about quality. And I was so inspired. I wanted to go work at the best place so I could learn from the best people. So I applied for the Waldorf Astoria, and I got the job at 19 years old. And I went in, I started working, and the place was a man. I was crazy. But that was so exciting to me. But what was so disappointing was that the food was this is back in the 70s and 80s. The food was, there was a lot of frozen food. There was instant potatoes and instant sauce. We just added water. There was no level of quality. People were not performing. They were not professional. It wasn't clean. It was very upsetting to me. But there was a moment every day where the chef came out, and he went down to the one kitchen I was working in. There were 12 kitchens, by the way, altogether. But the one kitchen I was working in, the chef would come down every night at about 5, 6 o'clock, and people would back up, and he would put these meals together for the VIPs that were in the towers. And at that time, it was people like Mrs. MacArthur, General Romolo lived there. Frank Sinatra lived there. There was the presidents of banks had their suites there, and dignitaries. The UN ambassador to the UN lives and still lives at the Waldorf. So there were plenty of VIPs, and the chef came out and took care of that. And I remember the moment like it was yesterday, where I would step back in awe at what he was doing and realize this is what I came here for. And I will someday make this for everybody. There's no reason why everyone can't have this. That's what made this place famous. That's what put it on the map. It's legendary service and legendary food. And if it was done then, it can be done now. We're just not doing it now because we got lazy and comfortable. And it's the easy way. So that became my vision and my desire. And I thought about it. It drove me and it gave me purpose every single day as I went through and tried to change and evolve. And with every obstacle that I faced, I was able to think about my vision. And as I came across obstacles and got through them, I got one step closer. And there were times where I got discouraged because it took a long, long time. And sometimes I asked myself, what am I doing here? It would be so much easier if I went somewhere else that was smaller with so less, you know, the militancy. The staff was militant back then. The chef who hired me, they took him out in an ambulance because somebody put lye in his food and burned his mouth. He left. The next chef came in, and he started trying to change things and make improvements. They lit his office door on fire and spray painted on the wall to back off. They were resistant to change, and they had the support of one of the strongest unions in the country. And so he left. And at that time, I became number two in charge. And as I spent my days trying to improve things and change things and get rid of bad behavior and bad people and put infrastructure and good recipes and quality food, CAB, one of the greatest things they ever did, bringing that in at 1980. That was the beginning of the trend of bringing great quality food in, but not to detract there. So I, in my mission to make improvements, I was given death threats. I was punched in the face. I had a 12-inch knife put to my chest. I had a pot swung at my head. Eventually, I woke up in Bellevue Hospital with a fractured skull. Somebody hit me in the head with a stainless steel pipe in the middle of the kitchen. I'm deaf in my left ear because of it. And so you ask yourself, well, what did you go back there for? I couldn't wait to go back because I had a mission. I had a vision. I had a desire to make this place different, and I knew that I could. And it was my vision for what I wanted and my great desire, fueled by passion, that got me back to work and eventually cleaned house. And eventually we transformed this operation into an operation where people were visibly passionate and excited about what they did. The kitchens were clean. They were spotless. The food was amazing. My dreams had come true by the time I left there. So that was my mountain to climb, and we all have one. But I never would have gotten through it if I didn't have the vision for what I wanted. So we also know that we're only going to be successful as we bring people around us that are as passionate as we are, at least that are good people, right? I learned that. But good people are like finding a needle in a haystack. That's why I got a haystack there, because they're so hard to find, okay? I used to review, I would say, if for the busy season, I would have about 8 or 9 positions open. And I would review 100 resumes. We would get from the schools and everywhere. We would put out ads, and I'd have 100 resumes. Of the 100 resumes, I probably interviewed only 15 people. And my interviews were legendary. People would talk about it for years. I'll never forget my interview with you. But I had it down to a science, so I thought, but I didn't. Of the 15 people I hired, no, of the 15 people I interviewed, I probably hired 8. Of the 8 people I hired, I probably kept 6. Of the 6 people I hired, I could tell you that one was the one, was the person that we all like to have around us. And what makes that person different than everyone else? This is a person, and you know them, they don't need to be told what to do. They don't need a job description, because when they see that something needs to be done, they just do it. They take the initiative to make change. They understand what you want and what they want, and they just get it done. And wouldn't it be great if we had everybody around us like that? Well, it doesn't really work like that. And so, but the problem is I would have to hire these people and then wait about 4 to 6 weeks to be able to identify that one. And I said, I can't do this. I need to be able to hire these people right from the beginning. So have you ever heard yourself say, and I know you have, so don't lie, don't shake your head no, what is he thinking? Probably said it within the last 24 hours, right? How about, it's just easier if I do it myself. Come on, get out of the way. I'll just do it myself. Can't anyone think for themselves? Great one. And then, am I the only one who sees what's going on here? So why does this happen? It happens for a couple of reasons. Number one, we may be surrounding ourselves with the wrong people. Some people just can't get out of their own way. They are the victims. Everything that goes wrong in life is against them, and they get swallowed up in this whole thing. You know what? They're never going to get here. So we could be surrounding ourselves with the wrong people. Perhaps we're not giving the message that we need to give. Perhaps we're not painting a picture of our vision of what it is we want. Maybe we're not giving crystal clear direction. Maybe we're not teaching people exactly what we want and how we want it done. It's an investment in time to developing people. And for us to think that just because we hired good people that they're going to figure it out, because that's what I did for years. Training? What do I need training for? I hire good people and train on-the-job training. They're going to learn and figure it out by watching other people. And if they don't, they can get out. Well, that was dumb, and that's what took me so long to get to where I had to go. We got to be proactive. We got to tell people what we want. We got to be crystal clear about it. We got to fill them with knowledge and information and hold them accountable. And that's how we're going to stop saying stuff like that. So the truth is, we're only as good as the people we surround ourselves with, right? Sounds like a good saying. We learned that. I believe that. It's a little weak, as you'll see in a minute, but it's true. Okay? So we've got to find good people to surround ourselves with if we want to get to where we're going to go. I talked about that person who takes initiative, and so it comes down to how do I find them from the get-go in the interview process. Kind of hard. But I realized if there were two questions, if I only had two questions to ask in an interview, and I wanted to find out if this person takes initiative, they're self-starters, because that's the person who's going to get to me where I'm going to go, those questions would be, tell me about some of the frustrations you had in your last job. And if you are attentive and seem amused by that, they'll go on forever. Because people love talking about everything that goes wrong in their life, and that's okay. Because that's the second most important question. The most important question is, what did you do about it? And if a person can't tell me what they did about some of the problems that they had in their life, in their organization, or where they were, I have no use for them, because chances are they're not going to do anything about it here. But if a person can tell me, give me examples of a problem that they were faced with and what it is they did about it, and it could be something extremely simple like, well, Chef, the garbage cans were always overflowing, and I say, well, what did you do about that? He says, I went to the hardware store and got an extra garbage can for my station so it didn't overflow. That's a person I want right there, because they're going to learn anything that I want to teach them. You know, my wife-to-be is a general manager of a hotel, and I love this story. She gave a kid an internship, unpaid internship for the summer. So on his third day at work, he has to bring something to a room. And the person had just had surgery, and they wanted to get a reclining chair so they'd be more comfortable. But the place, they were saying how the place wouldn't deliver it. Without saying anything to anybody, he gets his dad's car, drives out to the Bronx, gets the chair, brings it back, and brings it up to the guest. Doesn't say a word to anybody. Wasn't looking for credit. Just saw a need that somebody had and took the initiative to go and get it. I was so impressed with that. This is a person, nothing will stop this person, because they will always do what needs to be done. And these are the kind of stories we need to find from people. And if you ask them, they will tell you, and you can learn that. So rather than say we're only as good as the people we surround ourselves, that will get, if you get good people and you leave them alone, you'll get good. And if good is good enough, it's okay. Good was never good enough for me because it was never good enough for our customers. So I need to take good people and make them, help them to achieve their potential. So the level of our success is dependent upon our ability to help good people reach their full potential. And that's not easy, as we know. So here's a little exercise. I want you to think about a product that you like that you can say is both good and great. And I'll help you out. I'll give you some examples. So let's take shoes. Okay, shoes at Payless, they're going to go on your feet. They're going to get you where you got to go. Probably keep your feet dry. Okay, but there's a difference between those shoes and a pair of shoes that are hand-stitched with Italian leather and soles and made by hand. If you've ever seen a pair of shoes or boots made, it's really amazing. It's a lot of work. And there's a difference between those things. If you take a suit, there's suits that come that are machine made, and there are suits that are hand tailored with very fine fabric. And there's a lot of work and effort that goes behind every step of that process. We can go for a fast food burger, or we can get a dry aged prime certified Angus burger with some Wisconsin cheddar on a brioche roll with caramelized onions, a nice maple cured bacon, and maybe some heirloom tomatoes and a chipotle aioli on top with hand-cut fries with a little Parmesan cheese, right? They're both burgers. They're both burgers, but what's the difference? A lot more work went into one than it did the other. I love cars. Here's two cars. They both get us from point A to point B. They're both safe, right? They both look good. So what's the difference? The difference is the amount of time and energy and effort that went into the creation, the concept of a Mercedes-Benz over a Chevrolet. In the engineering process alone was monumentally, took more effort than that of a Chevrolet. The craftsmanship took more effort. The safety design took more effort. So what is the difference between good and great? Effort. It's clear that we need to surround ourselves with people that take initiative and get them to put great effort forward in order for us to be successful, right? And how do we get great effort from people? There's a couple of different ways we could do it. We could beat it out of them, right? We can yell and scream and pound our fists and demand it, right? Or get out, and you're going to get results. You will. Most people will respond, they'll either leave or they'll stick it out and they'll do it. But the minute you turn your back, they sit back and say, thank God he's gone. Now I can do my thing. Because it doesn't last, because it's not coming from here. It's coming from fear and intimidation. So it's unless you're going to stay there and watch somebody all day long, that's not going to work. Okay? Here's the worst thing. We let people stand on the sidelines and not participate because we allow the people that do take initiative and do work hard to cover for them. And that will tank an operation or an organization because the good people won't tolerate that for very long. They're not going to carry bad people on their back. So that's a really bad thing to do. Don't let people sit on the sidelines, hold them accountable, or get rid of them. The best thing we can do is inspire people to have a desire to get where we want them to go. Okay? Desire is key. So effort is fueled by desire, right? So how do we get people to desire something?